WLFP Braddock.
Good morning, travelers and diners of the world.
And drinkers.
And drinkers.
And any other listeners who would happen to be on the wrong place in the radio dial or tune their computer to onthemenuradio.com by accident.
Yes. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we have our first guest already on the line, Adam Heller, who is from Mangosteen, Adam's Mangosteen. Is that correct, Adam?
Hi, Ann. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for having me, Peter.
So what's one of those?
A mangosteen, it's an exotic fruit. It's originally from Southeast Asia, and it's that's the name of the fruit. It's a mangosteen. It's got a hard purple shell, and you can you open it with your hands, and it's got a white sort of sectional, like a tangerine, a white fruit, a white meat that is just delightful. It's rumored to be the queen of the fruits, and it's just got an excellent taste.
Now, is that in relation to the shorter version? Is there anything like a mango?
Unrelated to the mango at all, actually. It's the name came. It's originally from Malaysia, and the name in Malaysian is manggat, and that just got Britishized to mangosteen along the way.
Well, now, what we sampled was the juice and the nectar, and where to start with this? First of all, the reason that we're sampling this is because it's a high in antioxidant super fruit juice, right?
So we actually have two lines of products with the mangosteen. It's been great. We have a health supplement product that is high in antioxidant and is aimed at sort of the health food market. And then we have the nectar, which is sort of aimed at the gourmet and the gourmet restaurant and bar market. And the one for the health supplement has the rind of the fruit.
Oh, no, that's the one that, if you'll excuse me, I must say that, let me.
Spit it out.
I said, Peter, this tastes like it has to be healthy.
Exactly.
Inside a taste of dirt. I said, what is this? So, but anyhow, it grew on me. I got to actually crave it.
Okay, so that's the one that's in the bigger bottles, right?
Exactly.
See, I like that. The other one tastes totally different, the nectar, and I could understand the taste would be more appealing to most people.
The nectar is what we market as a mixer with margaritas or even champagne and creme de cassis. The nectar goes well with fish or lamb. We did a glaze, like a miso glaze. We have a recipe developer come up with about a dozen different recipes and get some really interesting things with the mangosteen.
How did you find these things?
So originally, I was living in Hong Kong in the early 90s, and tasted the mangosteen, and it really just stuck with me.
Uh-huh.
I had it's got a wonderful taste; it's very unique. And I lived in Southeast Asia, so I saw a variety of different fruits, but the mangosteen was the one that really stuck with me. I returned to the U.S. in the mid-90s, going to law school, in fact, and then felt that I needed a creative outlet outside of law school and wanted to get the mangosteen. And people said, well, you can't import it. There are problems with the government, and I took that as a challenge. And several years later, they were right, and it's actually only until last month that the fresh mangosteens are actually getting into the United States.
Yeah, we talked to Melissa's, the produce people, and they said that we were at the fancy food show, and they said that they should just get the approval any minute for mangosteens, so I guess they did.
The two governments approved it last month in June, and then they're doing a couple months of testing of the equipment. It has to be irradiated. And it'll be interesting to see how the market reacts to it. I was in Thailand in in May, and a couple of the suppliers were quite skeptical that the irradiation may be harmful. Mangosteen is a very delicate fruit.
I was going to ask you, what will that do to the fruit?
It's unclear. I've had irradiated papayas. There's a facility in Hawaii that is doing the same program.
Yeah.
And I think a papaya is a much sturdier fruit, so it'll be interesting to see how the how it turns out. It'll probably come out, though, as I said, in the next couple months.
Uh-huh. So the product you're buying is actually manufactured overseas?
We have suppliers in Indonesia, Thailand, and Vietnam, and we bring it in. They prepare it in various stages of processing, and then we all bring them together to the U.S. for final processing and bottling.
Now, was I doing something wrong when I was just drinking this mangosteen juice, the supplement one, just straight?
No, not at all. We have a lot. That's most of our customers, in fact, are drinking the mangosteen juice. So that's the it's meant to be drank cold. It tastes better, I think, cold over ice.
Right.
People mix it with a variety of things. Our customers, we have a couple thousand customers now, and we've gotten a variety of ideas: milk, orange juice, water, even club soda.
Yeah, I like it with sparkling water. It just cuts the density just a little bit. And I enjoyed it that way a lot.
See, I envisioned the density being proof that it was healthful.
We are actually coming out with another product later this year, aimed only at the bars, really. And we're taking the mangosteen and homogenizing it, so it won't separate uh-huh. as the current product does. So we're pretty excited about that. That'll be an interesting twist on it.
So you're just a mangosteen nut, huh?
It's a great fruit, and it's really just, it's been fortuitous that it turned out to be quite part of this group of superfruits.
Oh, you didn't know that?
High groups.
You didn't know that originally?
Originally, when I was involved in mangosteens in the early 90s, there wasn't a superfruit category.
Oh.
The superfruit, these fruits have really kind of come together mostly on the backs of palm, of the research that the folks who did palm. They actually sort of spurred this, what is antioxidant, and they started to verify some claims. And that sort of was the birth of the superfruits. So that was sort of in the late 90s is when they started.
We've been through the acai, the goji berry. What was the other one?
Noni.
The what?
Noni.
Noni I haven't gotten yet. I wrote and asked somebody for that, and nobody ever replied.
Now, what were those things from the Himalayas, those berries? Were they goji berries?
Goji berries.
Acai. Acai, okay.
No, goji.
Acai is from Brazil. The goji is from
Goji is from, okay. Yeah. Now, I came across another one, which is, oh, dear. It's one of those Chinese names with an X in it, Zhang Chinese something berry. It's a new one.
There are, and there's definitely a ton of them out there.
So there are lots more coming, huh?
Yeah, there's rambutan, dragon fruit.
Rambutan you get in the supermarkets.
Exactly. You can see that there's coming that out in a juice. There's also, like a snake fruit. And there's a variety of these. There's about 10 of the superfruits that are coming out. So we're actually going to be launching a goji juice ourselves next month.
Are you?
And at the end of the year, maybe a dragon fruit or maybe an acai.
Oh,
the
really?
Acai is, they've all got a very similar story. They're all exotic fruits, high in antioxidants, with slightly different angles, if you will.
Yeah. And then we've got yerba mate.
Exactly. That's another part of the whole group. They've done quite well.
Well, tell us, you have a website, right?
Mangosteens.com.
Right. And how is your product distributed?
So right now we are just breaking into the retailers. We started our first sale in March of 2006, and we've now got customers in 50 states and 5 different countries, and they're internet sales. And until last month in May, we started to get into our first retailers. So we're now in retailers in California and Texas, Delaware and Maine, and hoping to expand that pretty rapidly. Ramping up. The business has gone quite well. I mean, we've been fortunate that there have been other companies putting a lot of marketing dollars into mangosteen.
Really?
And you can find it at Costco. You can find, not our product, but the competitors.
I saw at the Fancy Food Show there was another mangosteen juice company.
Yeah.
But I don't remember what it was called.
Possibly Mango Zan or Zango. There are about, as I said, about 15 of them out there.
Oh, okay.
And they're at Whole Foods, they're at Costco. There's definitely a raising consumer awareness of mangosteen juice.
Well, how do you differentiate your product?
So we're unique. We are the only 100%, hence the company's name, Adams 100%, is we don't have any water, we don't have any other juices, we don't have any preservatives, any additives. It's 100% mangosteen. And we also make our product in a different manner. It's a fresh fruit puree, which is why it sort of tastes thick. It's not watered down. It's not concentrated. And whereas the competitors generally use a concentrate, and they'll use apple juice or pear juice or something to mix it out.
Yeah. Well, so people can go on your website, they can order the product, and watch for it also in your favorite supermarket, wherever you are. Right?
Exactly. And we have an 800 number as well, if I could.
Sure, would you?
800-646-8128.
That's great.
Open 24 hours.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, I really appreciate being in the forefront of this field, and keep us posted on your other ventures.
I will. Thank you very much for the time.
Yeah, I think we want goji's as a juice. The berries we got were rather hard.
Peter had to struggle with the goji berries.
We got some dried goji berries. Yeah, they're just not dried goji berries. Just aren't very interesting.
The goji juice is cranberry with a twist. It's got a little. It's definitely got a heavy red feel, but it's got a little bit of a sweetness to it. So I'm excited for it.
Great.
What is this? One, this fruit that smells so bad, but they say it tastes so wonderful.
The durian.
Yes.
Durian is the king of the fruits, whereas the mangosteen is the queen of the fruits.
I see. All right.
And the durian is they call it the stinky fruit, and it's formidable.
Now, but, listen, Adam, we've got a caller on the other line. You might want to say hello. I don't know if you know each other. This is Trevor Corson, who's written a book called The Zen of Fish.
No. Hi, Trevor.
Hello, Trevor. No.
We thought Trevor was...
I guess we lost Trevor.
I'm here.
Hey,
oh, Trevor,
there you are.
Trevor,
well done.
Trevor, say hello to Adam Heller, who has a company called 100% Mangosteen Juice.
Hi, Adam.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, well...
Likewise.
We were just wrapping up with Adam. We were talking about the super fruits, and I guess is it time for a break yet? So we'll be taking a break, so we'll say goodbye to Adam, and we'll say hello to Trevor. Trevor, can you hang on to the come back after the
sure.
break? Okay, so we'll take a break now.
The Internet is crucial to your business. Everybody knows this, but did you know Nidhogg is the company you should call for Internet service? Nidhogg, personal web page hosting for less. Business web page hosting, Nidhogg offers both Unix and NT server support. Nidhogg is the company you should call for dedicated Internet access. Nidhogg offers DSL for high speed, low cost, always on access. DSL is great. It means no more dial-up. Oh, by the way, do you remember that thing called the telephone? Do you remember when people used phone lines to access the internet? Oh, I'm sorry, you still use dial-up? Well, Nidhogg does that too. Local access telephone numbers? Okay, I don't understand it all either, but I do know that I need it, and I know where to get it. Nidhogg, Nidhogg.com, 412-661-5917. That's 661-5917, or log on, Nidhogg.com. Internet the Nidhogg way.
This Tuesday, be there as Dog the Bounty Hunter is sent to prison. This time, on the outside looking in.
I had to go back one more time.
Find out what made the star of the A&E hit series the man he is today.
I started to tell myself I can be anybody I want to be.
From ex-con to icon. It's the A&E special, A Man Called Dog. Tuesday at 9, 8 central, only on A&E.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Don't forget to check out our website, onthemenuradio.com, for all the... In fact, I wanted to post an update on this hot new pepper that they just pulled out of the north of India, but that I'll talk to you about later.
Yeah, I've known anything about that.
Yeah, well, I printed it and forgot to bring it. But meanwhile, we have Trevor Corson on the line, who wrote this, if you don't mind my saying, a fairly dense book on the Zen of Fish, but also sort of a thriller of sorts. Is that explaining it, Trevor?
Yeah, well, I try to combine a story with information, certainly, and that's what I do. And so it's the story of some characters, some real-life characters, young sushi chefs trying to learn sushi in Los Angeles, and then along the way of their story, you get all sorts of information about sushi, most of which is completely surprising to us.
I read this book from cover to cover. I wanted to know what was going to happen to Kate.
That's wonderful to hear because, yeah, I tell the story of this young woman, Kate Murray, who has no cooking experience and no knowledge of Asia, and she is totally adrift in this sushi training program, and so I followed her through that, and I'm glad to hear that it kept your attention.
Now, these are all real people?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Everything is real. Real people. I'm very meticulous about accuracy and, you know, making sure this is all nonfiction. So I followed these people every day, practically, through what they were going through, so I could write about it in detail.
The character I liked was the Japanese rock star.
Right. Yeah, there was this one Japanese fellow who came all the way from Japan to Los Angeles to learn sushi, and I was sort of surprised by that and seemed sort of suspicious. You know, why would he do that? And as you alluded to, it turned out he was a Japanese pop idol, a singer who was in hiding, trying to get a new career as a chef. So he had escaped Japan, where everybody knew who he was, and come to the U.S.
Well, wasn't the one occasion I sort of vaguely remember where someone said, sort of, you look awfully familiar.
Right. There was a Japanese customer who came in, and she was sure she'd seen him somewhere, but he was there, you know, in sushi chef garb behind the sushi bar. She didn't place the face of this pop idol singer she'd seen on TV, and she was trying to think what other sushi bar she'd seen him looking at.
And he did let on.
Right, he kind of hinted at it, but he didn't tell her the truth. I'm not sure if she ever figured it out. It was very funny.
Well, you really had a good time with this. You sound like you had a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, it was fascinating. I mean, I lived in Japan for 3 years and ate a fair amount of sushi there, but I knew nothing about it. And most of us don't know anything about it. You know, we love to eat it, but we don't know anything about it or how really to eat it and its history or any of that. And so it was a lot of fun to find this training academy in L.A. where they train Americans now to become sushi chefs. And I spent a semester hanging out there with these students and the chefs and the instructors, and it was a wild ride and very interesting and a lot of fun, and I just learned incredible things. I had no idea what I was getting into, and it was very interesting.
It's sort of like you have what do you call the thing when they're on the back cover, by Michael Ruhlman?
Blurb from Michael Ruhlman, right?
Yeah. And, I mean, he did that with the CIA. He hung out there, too, before writing The Making of a Chef.
Yeah, well, some of his writing was actually an inspiration to me because he, you know, writes in detail about students, you know, trying to become chefs. And I certainly am a fan of his writing. And you know, that was partly, I thought, what a great way to get into the topic of the cuisine. Because by following these students through their training to become sushi chefs, you know, I was able to stop along the way at various junctures in the story of their struggles in the classroom to take little side trips all about sushi. So when, you know, they were learning how to cut up each different kind of fish, that was an opportunity for me to talk about the weird and wonderful, you know, biology and food science and ecology of the different sea creatures that they were working on. And
now, are you a scientist by training?
No, I'm not. And I'm a
writer.
I was an Asian studies major, actually, and then came to journalism later. And so I'm a general interest writer and a nonfiction journalist. And I have taken just a kind of keen interest in how the world works and explaining that in an easy-to-understand way. And, you know, a lot of that involves I guess what you'd call science writing, but I don't even like to think of it as science writing because it's sort of taking, you know, the discoveries of science, and in this case, food science and marine biology, and just turning them into a kind of, you know, a celebration of all the wonderful facts about these creatures that we eat and, you know, why they taste the way they do.
Yeah, now tell us about your other book, The Secret Life of a Lobster.
Yeah, The Secret Life of Lobsters was my first book, and that came out of time that I spent working on commercial fishing boats off the Maine coast, and that's a similar book in the sense that it's a story about a group of human characters. In this case, a group of diehard fishermen living on a small rocky island off the coast of Maine, and then a very quirky team of eccentric marine biologists who were on this quest to understand the lobsters, lobster behavior, the lobster population, and the two groups of people ended up cooperating with each other on lobster research, which was a great story. And along the way, you learn all kinds of hilarious and wonderful things about lobsters and their
behavior.
Tell
me something funny.
It's a real soap opera down there.
Tell me something unusual about a lobster.
Oh my gosh, I mean, where to begin? They have these incredible social lives and romantic lives.
Romantic lives?
One of the surprising things I learned was that they can recognize each other as individuals. They actually live in neighborhoods on the ocean floor, and there's a pecking order established in every neighborhood, so everybody knows who the alpha male is, you know, and the mating hijinks that go on are just hilarious. You get all the female lobsters in the whole neighborhood all want to mate with the one alpha male, and the other males don't get any attention at all.
Are you sure you're not fantasizing this whole thing?
No. It's one of the wonderful things about doing what I do, which is this, you know, very factually based nonfiction writing, is that I'm very meticulous, as I said, and, you know, this is all documented science research that's been reported in scientific journals. And the fun part of my job was, you know, getting to know the scientists who dedicated their lives to finding this stuff out, and then taking all these quirky scientific discoveries they've made and writing it up in a way that's entertaining for the average reader. And that's what I do in both books.
I was trying to do that with snails, but I finally reached the point where I couldn't cope with it anymore.
Well, you never know.
They got to be too anthropomorphic for me.
Right. That, of course, is the danger. You have to be careful of not going too far with that.
Yeah, yeah, there's this funny thing that I think is posed in the book. I mean, sushi has become so incredibly popular. People eat it all the wrong ways. It's been Americanized to have avocados and all kinds of things that were never intended to be in there. But, I mean, do you think that if people knew how it originated, they would be quite as keen on it? I mean, it started out as a way of preserving fish.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the history of it is very surprising. It didn't originate in Japan at all. It comes from the inland areas of Indochina, Southeast Asia, and you're right, it was a way of preserving old fish for long periods. They would pack fish and rice. These are inland, you know, freshwater fish they get from rivers because they needed a way to preserve them, and because there was seasonal supply. And so they would pack it in cooked rice, and the rice would rot and, you know, become very disgusting and unappetizing, but that created acids that protected the fish inside from deteriorating. And so you could open this up and scrape off the disgusting rice and eat the fish inside, which would have fermented but wouldn't have gone bad. And so that's actually the original form of sushi, not fresh fish at all. As it spread up through the rest of Asia and over to Japan, people began to eat it sooner in the process, and they would actually eat it when the rice itself was also still edible but had fermented a little bit as well, and giving it a kind of acidic tang that people found tasty. I've tried this form of sushi. You can still get it in a few places, and it's not bad, but it's a totally different experience. I mean, it's more like eating, you know, a stinky aged French cheese than a fresh piece of sushi.
Oh, right.
Yeah, you also mentioned something else that a lot of people would find very strange in the U.S., and that is that darker fish like tuna and salmon were not part of the sushi tradition at all, and the Japanese really thought they were rather disgusting, and they wanted white fish in their sushi.
Right, yeah, this whole obsession with tuna, and especially the fatty cuts of tuna, is a modern phenomenon of the past few decades, post-World War II, really. You're quite right. Tuna were considered garbage fish in Japan. No one would eat them for sushi.
So they don't now, though. I mean,
yeah,
now,
well, what happened was the Western diet influenced the Japanese after the war, and they began to learn from us how to eat, you know, dark red meat and fattier cuts of meat, and that's how the whole tuna craze started. It's funny, in the book I provide kind of ecological bits of information for people to know about the different fish and, you know, the choices they can make. And with bluefin tuna, especially so overfished now, there's actually a lot of other more authentic sushi ingredients we can be eating that aren't as damaging to the environment. And In fact, on my website, thezenoffish.com, I have a kind of how to eat sushi page, which also addresses what you mentioned earlier, the whole question of how we eat it. And, you know, putting on lots of wasabi and soy sauce, and the way that we eat it in America is actually mostly wrong. And it's not that, you know, there's only one proper way to eat it. It's that you'll actually get more enjoyment out of the food, and you'll develop an interesting rapport with the chef if you try to eat sushi in the way that the Japanese do.
Yeah, don't dunk the rice into the soy sauce mixed with the...
Wasabi.
Wasabi.
Now let's make sure that we keep the cliffhanger going in this book too. There's this character called Kate, who begins at the beginning of the book, and it doesn't look like she's going to last through one class.
Right, and at the beginning.
and just like the Harry Potter story, we will not reveal what happens at the end.
I struggled a bit with I wanted to tell an American story about sushi, and so it took me a little while to figure out how I was going to do that. And the reason I decided to do it the way I did was that these characters, you know, Kate, for example, is she's not a sophisticated cook or anything like that. I mean, she's a very typical average American who doesn't really know anything about sushi herself going into it. And I decided to do that because I thought that on the whole, people would be able to relate to her, and that, you know, her struggles would actually be easy for most American readers to understand and relate to, because most of us don't really know much about sushi.
Yeah, well, don't give away too much about
this. The question of her being a woman, too, she had to struggle against gender discrimination in the world of sushi.
Their hands are too hot for sushi. Trevor, don't give away any more of your secrets, but do tell us one more time your website.
Yeah, it's thezenoffish.com, or just zenoffish.com, zenoffish.com, and I've got all kinds of information about the book on there and about sushi, and I have a sushi blog, and there's a lot of fun stuff on there for people to check out.
And you can get the book by going to the bookshelf page on the Menu Radio's website.
I've got links on the website, and of course you can look for it on Amazon or any of your local bookstores.
You don't have to go any further than onthemenuradio.com. It's there too.
It's right there. So,
Trevor, wonderful to talk to you.
We're getting waves from the control booth about how we're running out of time, so it's time to take a break.
Okay.
But keep us on your mailing list for your next book.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your interest in this one. It was great talking with you.
Well,
thanks,
you're
Trevor.
Fun to talk to. Thanks, Trevor.
Take care.
Okay, bye. So we'll take a break.
The flagship station of the Lifestyle Talk Radio Network. This is 1550 WLFP, Pittsburgh.
Hi, friends. I'm Phil Marcus, the host of Real Estate 101, heard every Saturday here on The Edge, AM 1550. If you've been thinking about selling your house or buying a house, I'd like to speak with you. Choosing the right agent is one of the first and most important steps in the process of buying or selling real estate. It's critical that you choose an agent who has the knowledge and experience to not only find that perfect new home for you, but to also be able to guide you step by step through the often complicated real estate process. If you don't already have a realtor, may I offer my services? I've been a real estate agent in Pittsburgh for almost 30 years. I'm a life member of the Realtors Association, and I'm proud to say that I've earned both the GRI and the coveted CRS professional designations. Won't you call me at RE/MAX Heritage? The phone number is 412-241-4200, extension 154, or my email address is phil@philmarcus.com. That's 412-241-4200, extension 154, or phil@philmarcus.com. Let's talk.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
Yeah, we beat those gremlins one more time.
We technical gremlins. We have on the phone now yet another guest, William Stadium, who you're quite a gossip, Bill.
A gossip.
You're a great gossip. You've written best-selling books, The Marilyn Monroe Confidential, Dear Senator. You've done screenplays for one of my most favorite programs is L.A. Law. You've done everything. I'm reading through all this stuff. You were restaurant critic for Buzz, which was is it defunct? It is, isn't it?
Yes, it went out of business and it merged into Los Angeles Magazine, where I was a restaurant critic for years after that happened.
Yeah, I did that for Pittsburgh Magazine.
Uh-huh.
I was so thrilled the year we beat Buzz.
but is this your this is your first food book or not?
It's actually my first food book, okay. Although food figures into all my books because whenever you write about rich and famous people, they love to eat. I wrote one book about King Farouk of Egypt, and if you look at the size of him, you could see how much he liked
him. Oh, that would be fun.
Yeah, yeah. I'm old enough to remember him.
Right. He was a big eater. And then I wrote about my last book, next to last book, was called Mr. S, about Frank Sinatra in the 50s and 60s. And
oh, that's right. That was food,
he's
too.
He's very famous for liking, you know, associated with great Italian food, but actually he didn't like to eat. He wanted to be skinny. And the only food he really liked was Campbell's pork and beans. So,
but you have him in all these restaurants.
The Italian gourmet is quite a big one.
Oh yeah! Now tell our listeners about this book. It's called Everybody Eats There.
Well, it's sort of the best way to describe it is around the world in 80 meals, or it's actually around the world in 100 meals. Is that I basically went to what I considered the 100 most classic restaurants in the world. They're not necessarily the restaurants with the greatest food, but they are the restaurants with the greatest people and the people who like to go on a regular basis. And those people are rich, famous, celebrated. People can eat anywhere in the world they want. This is where they like to go for whatever reason, and I wanted to find out those reasons. And I did an odyssey around the world, east to west, north to south, both hemispheres, all the hemispheres, everything. And found these wonderful restaurants, and it's sort of I wouldn't call it a diary, but it's, you know, there's a profile of each of these restaurants. And once you've read the book, you know exactly where to go, and you can plan your next 20 trips based on this book if you like to eat.
Well, problem is, though, most of them you can't get into.
No, actually, these restaurants are not trendy. Okay. I find that the restaurants that are really hard to get into are the restaurants of the minute. And these restaurants are restaurants of the century. These people, but most of these restaurants have been around for decades, if not centuries. And so the hardest restaurants, I'm here in New York City now, and there
yeah,
are all these super
Balthazar.
Trendy restaurants that have press agents, and they'll be around for a year or two, and then they'll be gone and empty. But those are not the restaurants I've written about.
Yeah, you have Balthazar.
Balthazar once started out as a very trendy restaurant, but it sort of morphed into a classic.
Uh-huh.
Because it looks old, and it feels old, but it's fairly new. But it developed its own patina of age, and now if you want a classic bistro or brasserie experience in New York, that's the best place to go. And it feels like it's been there for centuries.
Now you do get some pretty new restaurants in there, though. One that we ate in London ourselves, and we got the same story you did about how popular it was with the beautiful people, called China Tang.
China Tang. The reason I put that in is that David Tang in Asia is sort of venerable. And if you go to...
Yeah, we met him.
He's quite a great
character.
He has
the most expensive suits I've ever seen on anybody.
Oh, I know. Well, he has these clothing stores which have these fabulous looking things.
He is one smooth operator.
He is. He's very charming. Like Mr. Chow in some ways.
Uh-huh.
They're very similar in that... they're both from wealthy Chinese families who didn't want to do the conventional thing, even though Mr. Chow went way off the deep end. He started as a hairdresser. David Tang was a, you know,
clothing.
Lawyer and then a university professor.
Oh,
but they both went into the sort of food and entertainment business and with great success.
Yeah, well, we interviewed him in his restaurant this last February,
I think it was.
Yeah, and he was smooth.
He was a very smooth operator.
Boy, was he a smooth operator.
He could be a diplomat.
He could indeed. In fact, he is.
He is. You have to do it to have a global empire the way he does.
Yeah, I don't know who was in that night, but he was anxious to get away from saying hello to our listeners because somebody important had arrived.
Yes.
All right. Well, he has his priorities.
Now, it's interesting that in New York, you talk about the old French restaurants of New York and La Grenouille, but you don't mention Le Perigord. And Georges Breguet, the owner of Le Perigord, was actually a guest on our program.
He's a lovely guy.
A couple of years ago.
I've been to his restaurant many times over the years. It's a classic, too. I'd love to be able to have more and more volumes because to have a sort of you know, a 300-page book, it's an arbitrary ending, and you can only have so many.
All right.
But
so
not only that, but when did you do this? Because it changes day to day.
It does. It doesn't. And one of the tests for the book I was looking at was, will the restaurant be here 5 years after the book is out? Mm-hmm. So people don't have to.
Or the other test
disposable.
Is.
So that's sort of my test. Now, of course, I failed the test on one thing, that I have a collaborator on the book whose family owns Morton's Restaurant, and that's the one restaurant that's gone out of business since the book came out in Los Angeles, the famous Morton's where they have the Vanity Fair party.
They went out of business.
It's gone.
So eventually places go.
Oh, it's going. They've announced closure. I think it's around for a few more months.
Now, you have, in fact, next month we're going to be staying in an apartment right near Chez L'Ami Louis.
Oh, boy, well, don't eat there too often because you'll get so fat you won't be able to eat anywhere else.
Love those potatoes.
Oh, Peter loves those potatoes.
Absolutely fabulous.
They are great. And, you know, there's nothing better than their potatoes. And that chicken is a magnificent bird.
Well, we had one of those baby lambs where they bring the leg that's the size for two.
Uh-huh.
I mean, first of all, I've never had some.
Yeah, but you haven't.
That's a wonderful place, and that's an interesting neighborhood for you to choose to live in.
Well, it's actually a friend of ours bought the apartment.
Well, it's smart. It's a wise future investment because that's becoming a very trendy neighborhood in Paris.
It's a very good
place. It's such a classic. It's so decrepit, and you can break your neck going downstairs to the facilities, and people have.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's a risk worth taking.
Yeah, so, no, I mean, I think that he got it for a really good price, but there was, he said, but of course we have to put in a kitchen.
Right, you have to.
No, that's in the apartment, not in the restaurant.
They barely have a kitchen in the restaurant. It's very small. To think of the giant portions that come out of what's a tiny little stove, really, in the back. There's not much room there.
Yeah, we had the famous $50 asparagus appetizer.
Oh, boy.
French fashion is I got the it's in season too for green asparagus, and I got the menu with no prices on it.
I told you how much they were. You're making up a story.
No, but you started kicking me after the tables.
Well, you don't want to ask too many. You know, well, they say that if you have to ask about how much it costs, you shouldn't be there because it could really give you serious indigestion.
Yeah, but it was a bistro. You know, what did I know?
Well, you had a great time.
It was a great time.
Yeah, sure. We arrived in Paris. This is how the wealthy people who have on the menu radio do for a living. We arrived in Paris early in the morning. We had lunch at Les Amis Louis, and we finished up with dinner at Le Grand Vafour.
Whoa! That was a day and a half.
That was a wild day.
When I was the restaurant critic for Los Angeles Magazine, my very first article, which was a great fun piece, was to go and find where the French two- and three-star chefs, the famous chefs of France, liked to eat when they came to L.A.
Uh-huh.
So I was there for 2 weeks in France. I stretched it out. And every day I'd have either two three-star meals or one or two two-star meals or a three-star two-star every day. And by the end of those 15 days, I hated fancy food and never wanted to eat again.
Yeah,
I mean, because every morning I'd work out in the gym for an hour, then between lunch and dinner, I'd walk about 5 miles to try to make room for dinner. And, you know, it seemed like the dream job to eat glorious food every minute of the day.
Yeah.
But you can only do it, you know, it's only good maybe one day of a lifetime or one day of a holiday.
Yeah, but you never could, when I was doing the restaurant review thing, nobody could believe that I didn't just absolutely adore just cramming all that food in my mouth.
No, it's too much. You feel
it gets
like a
you don't want anything.
A stuffed goose, and that's why the easiest country to sort of eat in is Italy because you can eat more simply every day. It's great, but it can be lighter. France, you sort of the fancy restaurants are generally rich, and Italy it's not that way.
Yeah. Now, if in Paris, what? Do you know small restaurants that the famous people don't go that we should check out?
Oh, you know, there are a lot of little mom and pop places, but they, you know, they're a vanishing breed. It's a class that's growing extinct. I like in Paris. I like to go, and it's not in the book. The Balzar, the Brasserie Balzar. It was taken over by this awful chain that devoured all the other famous classic places like La Coupole and a lot of the other great, sort of 1920s classics. But the Balzar, there was a two-piece piece in the New Yorker about there was a protest of the neighborhood. They didn't want this octopus to devour their restaurant. And they did devour it, but they kept all the standards. That's a little brasserie on the left bank. I think it's the perfect brasserie in Paris. And, you know, you go for, you know, kind of a mi Louis Mio, but you get a simple, like a vegetable puree vegetable soup, a roast chicken, French fries, and some wonderful Beaujolais, and you had a happy meal there.
That's great, yeah. I liked your choices for London. I thought they were interesting.
Well, I tried to get, you know, London, there's such classic places, especially the hotel. London is probably the world capital, sort of famous hotel dining with Claridge's, and especially the Savoy Grill was, you know.
Yeah,
so you're steeped in such history, even though Gordon Ramsay has taken over all these places now, and he's Frenchified the food. The rooms are so beautiful and so classic that you really feel like you've stepped into a Noel Coward drawing room comedy.
Yeah, I had the opportunity when we were in London last, William, to interview the maitre d' who was the maitre d' for years at the Savoy, and then he moved to Brown's just after it reopened, and he had fabulous stories of,
I bet he did.
Of what it was like, and how you acted when you're a maitre d' in order to be able to make sure that if the two people who had their favorite table arrived at the same time, you could figure out how to seat them.
Talk about diplomacy. That's
exactly
really
exactly.
Well, anyhow,
but,
this book
I talk about the famous seating chart at the Savoy Grill from from I think the 50s, it was when it was, and the lineup, it's really like what the Yankees called Murderer's Row. I mean, every table was somebody of world class fame, whether they were politicians or Nobel Prize winning scientists or movie stars or recording stars or stage stars. But you had to be famous or you didn't get in. So the Savoy Grill is really sort of the model. The old Savoy Grill is the model of the power celebrity restaurant that this book celebrates.
Well, tell our readers, or I'm telling the listeners, rather, to all read this book called Everybody Eats There. Do you want to give us it's on our website, is it?
Not yet, but it will be.
Okay, we're going to put this on our website, Bill, so
that
people
can
go.
Thank you. It's a great place to be.
Yeah, and they can go and just click right on and get that book. And otherwise, do you have a website you'd like to give us?
I don't. I mean, it's on Amazon, so you can always get it there.
I mean, you personally.
No, I don't have my own website.
Oh, my.
I'm very low-tech. One of these days, I've got to get it together. But I barely learned how to type on the computer, so.
Okay, well, we're getting mad signaling from the control booth here saying that we've got to take a break and run some ads. So I want to thank you for joining us, and a pleasure reading your book.
Thank you
and,
so much.
Yeah, and keep in touch.
Okay, great to talk to you.
Okay, thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye now.
Take a break.
Data security and speed can be what puts your business ahead of your competition, but cost is important too. You might be paying every month for bandwidth you don't use. Let's talk about your company's disaster recovery system. Is it as effective and secure as it could be? What are you paying for your T1 line? I'll bet we can offer you a better deal. We're ASP Station, a premier independent server co-location facility and high-speed internet access provider. Virtually unlimited bandwidth, co-location for your backup servers, off-site system backup, and secure access to your equipment 24/7. Check us out on the web at aspstation.net or call us at 412-661-6001. Easy number to remember, 412-661-6001. ASP Station, 412-661-6001.
Hello, my name is Kathy Brennan, and I'm the marketing maestro at Acapella Marketing. I help small businesses take their marketing up an octave. Are you trying to grow your business? Would you like to more effectively position yourself versus your competition? Would you like to bring more prospects into your business? As the marketing maestro at Acapella, this is what I do. My clients view me as an extension of their team, not an outside consultant. I bring the marketing tools that will fit your business. My clients benefit from a range of services such as internet advertising campaigns, marketing planning and strategy, and ongoing marketing support. Do you want to grow your business? Do you want to race past your competition? Do you want to bring more prospects into the business? My name is Kathy Brennan. I'm the marketing maestro at Acapella Marketing, and I'd love to talk with you about your business. For a free one-hour consultation, please contact me at 412-242-7785.
This Tuesday, be there as Dog the Bounty Hunter is sent to prison. This time on the outside looking in.
I had to go back one more time.
Find out what made the star of the A&E hit series the man he is today.
I started to tell myself I can be anybody I want to be.
From X-Con to Icon. It's the A&E special, A Man Called Dog. Tuesday at 9, 8 central, only on A&E.
Welcome back. We're going to take a little jump to the Fancy Food Show
in New York.
We're jumping. Joy, because it's always a treat to go and spend 3 days roaming the cavernous
Javits Center,
tasting all the new foods.
Yeah, and we found some really interesting ones.
We did.
And we picked the most interesting ones to start off with.
Yes, we're going to talk to, well, it's right on there.
Yeah.
Why don't we just run the tape and they'll tell us who we're talking to.
Michael Levasseur, am I pronouncing that right, Michael?
You certainly are. It's a very good effort.
Of the Organic Smokehouse is one of the most interesting exhibitors that we've encountered. Michael, just could you please explain to our listeners what you do? What is your business?
We're a smokehouse, but the thing that's different about us is that everything we do is organic. So we only smoke organic products, and we're the only smokehouse in Britain that is purely organic production. So we're fairly unique like that. We're smoking, the thing we're probably most known for is our smoked salmon. We smoke a range of cheeses, butter, salt, olive oil, and then we have a number of other products that some of the well-known chefs in Britain will approach us for to smoke for them.
You do custom work. Could you explain what's involved in that?
A number of the chefs will come to us, the Michelin star chefs, and can we smoke things like chocolate and milk and very unusual products. We smoke very traditionally, but have a reputation for very innovative, developing innovative products and working with the chefs. So we're giving them an opportunity to push the boundaries of what they can do and haven't been able to do before with some pretty unusual products.
How did you get into this business?
Oh, 20 years ago, I was a Harris Tweed weaver in Scotland, and it was a bit quiet. The exchange rate against the dollar wasn't very favourable. Most of the work was in the States. And there's a chap nearby who was smoking, so I just went and helped him and learned from there in the 80s and have done it on and off ever since. And then been full-time. I was working in London and got fed up with the commute and the office life. So gave it all up 5 years ago, went totally organic production, and I've been doing it ever since.
Now, you're near Ludlow in the UK. How people stop by and buy retail from you. Could you direct them? Or do you have a phone number or an email address or website?
The website is organicsmokehouse.com. Phone number is 01588-660-206. And people turn up every day. We're not easy to find. But if you can get to the village of Clunbury, people will always direct you to us. And at 10 o'clock at night, people come and hammer on the door.
Well, you must be having an awful lot of fun.
Yes, it is. It's really interesting. I work 7 a.m. to midnight, 7 days a week. And it's really interesting. Meet great people. And it's just a really fun thing. And it's an honest living as well. It's making something which people like, which is very satisfying.
Well, you're a very wonderful man. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks a lot.
He was a fascinating guy. He looked a lot like a banker.
Yeah, he did. I loved him.
It's really, really unusual. Now, we didn't mention this in the interview, but he actually does have a set of standard products as well. So they make smoked salmon and a variety of other products. So if you want to know more about that, you can find it out at the organicsmokehouse.com.
Right. Now, we did pick some interesting people to interview at the show. Now, this is like one of my most favorite places. It's Real Wasabi.
Doug Lambrecht, Real Wasabi, LLC. This was the first product that absolutely popped out at us at the Fancy Food Show. Original, fabulous. Tell us what Real Wasabi is to start with.
Well, the story really starts with what most wasabi isn't. Most wasabi has no wasabi in it at all. Most wasabi is made from horseradish, cornstarch, mustard, and food coloring. We discovered this fact about 10 years ago, started researching the potential of growing authentic wasabi in North America. And we grow wasabi on our farm in the mountains of North Carolina at about 3,500 foot elevation. And we really started the company, Real Wasabi, at realwasabi.com to have an outlet for the produce that we grow on our farm.
What does it look like?
Well, wasabi is a slow-growing rhizome. It's a perennial plant that grows in spring water. It'll also grow in earth, but the best wasabi in the world is grown in pure spring water. It's a low plant. It's about maybe 18 inches high at its tallest. It has a thickened stem that some people refer to as a root. It's actually a rhizome. And it's that thickened stem that is most valued for the pungency and the unique flavor, which is unlike horseradish.
I saw one of your crew using a shark skin grater.
Traditionally in Japan, there's a shark skin grater referred to as an oroshi. And when you grate the wasabi rhizome in a circular pattern, it produces a very creamy paste, which is just the right consistency to activate the enzymes. The actual flavor of wasabi itself, if you were to sniff the root, it has no odor. If you were to cut it and taste it, it has very little flavor. And the actual flavor evolves from an enzymatic action. Technically, it's the exposure of something called glucosinolates with a myrosinous enzyme that transmutes the flavor into a suite of isothiocyanates. And those isothiocyanates are the result of large phytomolecules, sulfur-containing molecules, that are a sister of mustard, but it's a totally different flavor from horseradish or mustard.
Ooh, that's heavy stuff. Were you a scientist before this?
No, not at all. I'm actually an investment advisor, but I got into the science side because my original interest was in medicinal plants, and I discovered, much to my surprised, that not only most wasabi sold in the world is fake, but the real authentic wasabi has some potential properties which are quite promising. It's antibacterial, which is why, of course, it was paired with raw fish for so many hundreds of years in Japan.
Oh, you have more information. Now, of course, you sell it, like, in a jar, is it, already grated?
Well, actually, we sell wasabi products across the board. We started the company growing wasabi on our farm and selling fresh wasabi as well. We then dry and grind the wasabi into powders, which we sell in three sizes. But our real flagship line is a line of certified organic sauces and dressings. We make a wasabi ranch, which is fabulous, a wasabi and marin. Marin is a sweet rice wine. And we make a wasabi and marin vinaigrette. We make a wasabi balsamic vinaigrette. We make a wasabi Caesar. And then we had four sauces, a wasabi ginger, which is outstanding. It's got a ginger in it from Hawaii, organic ginger. It's really terrific flavor. We've got a wasabi teriyaki sauce. We have a wasabi peanut sauce that just won product of the year from the peanut board. And we also have a brand new flavor called wasabi and soy, which is a marinade, a sauce, and a dressing, and it's just outstanding.
Tell us now, this is my favorite thing with the nuts. Tell us about your nuts.
Well, the wasabi nuts are a brand new line for us. There are a lot of wasabi peas and wasabi nuts out there, but our belief in our company is that the flavors should be balanced. And we come up with, it took us a long time, but we came up with a blend of authentic wasabi and other spices to lightly dust our lightly roasted nuts. And what happens is the nut doesn't, the spice doesn't overpower the nut. There's a balance between the creamy flavor of the cashew and the nice flavor of the spice, the wasabi. Our spice, you know, our blend is a very careful concoction to enhance the natural flavor of wasabi. We refer to that natural flavor as the fiery taste, smooth finish.
And the nuts you use are pistachio, almond, and cashew?
At this point, it's pistachio, almond, and cashew, and a mix of those three.
I'd like to put you in touch with these macadamia nut people.
Well, you know, macadamia is on our radar screen as well. It's a fabulous flavor. It's got a lot of rich depth to it, and it's a perfect complement to the macadamia.
We're going to have to close this down, and I could talk with you forever about this. Just throw out a website.
Well, you can buy direct from us at www.realwasabi.com, or you can buy through Whole Foods, Wild Oats, Kroger's, many independent retailers. We're growing fast. We're in our second year, but we're getting a pretty good footprint nationwide.
I want all of those products. I love them. Thank you very much.
It's our pleasure. Thanks very much for coming by.
Yeah, I loved them. You know, we couldn't take them any samples because we couldn't carry anything. And no. Now they're out of them. I asked for some, and don't have any.
Well, they were very successful. They deserve to be very successful.
Yes.
The curious thing is, we had come across wasabi before being grown in Oregon, but apparently the guy who was doing that gave up. It was actually mentioned in the Zeno Fish book. We should have mentioned to Trevor. I don't think he knows about these people.
Oh, dear. Well, we'll have to you'll email him.
We'll have to make that connection.
But here's a ta-da moment. The very best.
Ta-da, ta-da, ta-da.
The very best new product of all these 2,800
products. Not only that, but we said it was going to be.
Yes. The Terrell's Chips.
Alan Jack is export manager of Terrell's Chips. And this product is, somebody cornered me who I knew and said, if you want to taste the best potato chips you've ever tasted in your whole life, go to Terrell's. And you are up for best new product, aren't you?
Yes. We've been entered by Chelsea Market Baskets for our sweet chili potato chip, which is one of our new flavors that we've launched over the approximately about 8 months ago. So it's just come over into the States.
Tell us the story of these potato chips. Why are they so wonderful?
Okay, Terrell's actually started 5 years ago where we wanted to have a product that we could use from our own homegrown potatoes. We've got our own farms in the UK and Herefordshire, and what we do is we grow only older variety potatoes such as Lady Clare and Lady Rosetta. With that, we decided what we needed to do is have a product with provenance. And so we hand cook the products. And with that hand cooking process by our trained chefs, then what they do is we control everything from the seed all the way through to the chip. We also carefully select our spices that have provenance. For example, we'll use Maldon sea salt on our sea salt, lightly sea salted chips, and also our sea salt and crushed black pepper chips. So that gives us a lot more provenance in what we do. Everything is carefully selected, is done in small batches, so there's total control of what we do.
And you're also doing something with vodka, I understand.
Yes, what we have is a lot of excess small potatoes, and instead of selling those on commodity market, what we've decided to do is distill a premium vodka, which is going to add a lot more provenance to what we do as a business and create another revenue stream within the business and help also generate things going on with the small farmers within our region.
This is one of the most crowded booths at this fancy food fair. People really like this product.
Yes, it certainly is. We first showed the products actually in San Francisco in January, and we had over 3,000 people on our booth. And that gave us the inspiration to actually come to New York, where we're told it's going to actually have a lot more fine food people coming through. And this is where we target our products, actually in the fine food sectors. We haven't been in the main retail stream, retail stores. It's always been in the select premium fine food stores.
And how do people get your product? Can you get it on the internet?
We've got two importers in the States, Chelsea Market Baskets in New York, and then we have British Wholesale Imports. Chelsea Market Baskets do have an internet sales system that people can get it from them. I'm not sure what their website is, but they can just look it up and under Chelsea Market Baskets and see it. BWI, I'm not sure if they have it on internet, but they've got a various distributor network that they sell it to. So, for example, we can also get it at Dean & DeLuca very shortly, as well as Whole Foods in the New York region, and also into central markets in Texas, and also Cost Plus World Market stores.
Well, listeners, it's spelled TYRRELL'S. And I would Google it. I would ask in my Whole Foods market. I would go online to the distributors because it's really worth it. Fresh, crisp, and wonderful. Alan, thank you.